I Wore the Wrong Shirt to Work Today is a series of short stories that have been recorded and produced in cooperation with CoastSiderRadio.com. They are intended for the express listening pleasure of the CoastSiderRadio.com community.
Chapter 3, Parts Everywhere, Both Ears, and Lost Doobies. I had just gotten married. It was spring 1975, and I was sitting by the pool at the apartment we rented. Before this, I had lived in a small canyon in the foothills, and my roommate at the time brought home another guy and said, "Here's our new roommate." Okay, that was the first time I met Tim, and now he was on the phone. I was called in from the pool to answer the phone that sunny morning, and it was Tim inviting us to join him and his wife on a trip to the desert to rent his new sand buggy. I was not thinking that driving around in the dirt was going to be fun, but we didn't have anything else to do, so why not? We met them at their house with our car camp things, and we were ready to go. Tim and I were both heavy drinkers, and I was in love with pot. Neither of the women were interested in these options. Funny why we were all together looking back on it. We drank and stopped for piss breaks for 3+ hours that it took to get to what you could only call hell's next-door neighbor. We pulled into the campsite, and it was already late at night, and I had never set foot in this desert before. We rolled the buggy off the trailer, loaded up the cooler with beer, grabbed the joints, and said we'd be back in a while. This was my first ride in a sand rail, and it would not be my last for sure. Without digressing on engines and the current state of speed, I will just say this. We were the fastest thing on the sand that night. I met the other cast of characters, and we all got totally blitzoid. Tim said, "Let's go back to the bar before it closes and get some more beer, and we'll stay out all night." Okay. We left everyone at the sandhill and started making our way through the whoops and the tight turns that headed back to the highway. We crossed the state route and angled up a very rough shoulder of a small asphalt road. Up until that moment, I was having the time of my life. Warm summer night in the desert, drinking, smoking, and running gas through carburetors. Heaven on earth. Tim looks over and says, "I wonder how fast it will go on the asphalt." There was no time for me to comprehend that thought. Before I could even pause to think about it, we were on the asphalt. It had to be at least 1:30 in the morning. Tim hit second gear, wound it out, and reached for third. He got about halfway through third gear when we launched and were totally airborne as the front end came up, straight up off the road, and the drive wheel had spun us up and flung us down the road. This all happened in a few brief moments. My memory is vivid, as there wasn't much to remember. I brought my arms inside the roll cage and hunched forward as we started touching down and rising up and touching down, and I think we were rolling over and over and over. Tim was yelling, "Are you okay?" And I was yelling, "Yes, I'm okay." And suddenly we were sliding through the dirt on the driver's side of the car as we sheared off a road sign at its base and slid to a stop about 1 foot from a telephone pole. I'm really glad the telephone pole was last, or we would have been dead 36 years ago. I popped my belt and fell down out of my chair and landed on Tim. We both climbed out through the top of the roll cage. Tim looked at me and pulled his hair back on the side of his head and asked, "Is my ear still there?" I looked and confirmed. He said, "Then I'm okay. How about you?" I thought about it and said, "Yeah, I'm good." I guess the crash made some real noise because people started showing up asking questions. Tim asked some people to help him turn the thing over, and he'd limp it back to camp. I remember the laughter, and I heard someone say, "It's over, Tim. Your gas tank is back there. Your wheels are bent under. Your carburetors are MIA, and all the tires are flat." I reached for a joint and realized they were gone. They must have fallen out of my shirt pocket while I was upside down. This was the worst part of the crash for me. I was fine, but all of my smoke was gone. "Do you want to go get a trailer, Tim?" someone asked. So typically Tim, he answered, "No, let's just drag the fucker back." We did just that. We were invited to go back out in the other people's cars that night, and I wished I hadn't gone. It only got scarier, but that is a story for another time. In the morning, the girls woke up. We didn't. That was the end of a very good time. I bought a sand rail a few weeks later and ran off-road for 25 years. I left in the middle of the night. Somewhere I had completely lost it. Yeah, I could go backwards and outline all the reasons why I was justified, but I know it wouldn't change the outcome. I was sad and angry, tired and confused. but mostly angry, I think. My anger had nothing to do with current things. It was resonating from deep within. My best friend stateside had mailed a few Reds. Yep, mail drugs right under everyone's nose. You gotta love 1969 technology. For those who are not schooled in street drug lingo, a Red is a barbiturate. In this case, a chemical cocktail that flew by the name Seconal. It is prescribed as a sleeping pill. So I took two of them at 2 a.m. and quietly packed my room with everything I could carry. I assumed I would need money and that I could sell things later. 30 feet away on the same floor, my father, his wife, my two little sisters, and a three-month-old baby brother were sleeping. This would be the last time we would all live under the same roof. Regardless of the reasons, regardless of anything, it was terribly sad. And at that moment, and to this very day, remains the saddest moment in my life. So why did I leave? How could I have gotten two suitcases and a guitar down a flight of stairs and through the front door without someone hearing me? I stumbled to the underground, and I think I waited for the first train. I honestly do not remember if I found a cab. It was cold, and I do not know how else I could have gotten downtown. I am completely blank on these details, but I made my destination at Baker Street, London West 1. I joined the chess master and his girlfriend, and it was game on. There was no way I could explain how this all came about without writing a short novel probably titled something like Dumb Fuck Thought He Knew Everything. I was still in high school in an American curriculum school that my father arranged. I had no idea what I was doing. Seriously no idea. So I went to school that morning. I was pie-eyed, hungover, desperate, and afraid. School felt warm and safe. 3 or 4 days went by, and I was getting accustomed to my new routine. And then my father finally figured out where I was. The school's principal ordered me to call him. I refused to do so from her phone, and she sent me off campus to make the call. I went to the tea house and had a cigarette and went back to school. The next day, when she found out that I had not made the call, she was furious. I did not care what she was. Somewhere along the years that followed, I was told by someone, I do not remember who, that my father had sat in the swing in the backyard every evening for days after I left and just stared at nothing. Here's the truth. He was feeling what I had felt so many years earlier, when I would sit on the curb and wait for him to come home. And like me back then, he knew I wasn't coming. That was heavy and still hurts to this day. And there is so much more to add. But it doesn't just roll all together, at least not for me. I do this one day at a time to keep from being swallowed up in trivia. I can tell you that about 10 years later, my father and I were friends again and remained that way until he died some 25 years later. Seasons change, people don't. That was what I was once told. I struggled with that thought, but I believe it is true. My father both loved me and resented me, and I in turn loved him and could never forgive him for leaving me. Stay tuned, because I'm going to tell you about a meditation I was taught that helped me deal with this sadness. It is easy to do, and it will help you cry. Fat fucking Freaky Fred. I know at the end of the last story I mentioned a meditation that I had learned and was going to share it with you. This is a powerful meditation, and the subject revolves around sadness, and I think I will come back to that another night. So for now, I will talk about how I met Fat Fucking Freaky Fred. I was looking for a new place to live up in the canyons, and I heard about this little second house on a 5-acre ranch on the main canyon. Later accounts, according to Fred's wife, was that I told her I was a born-again Christian. I know I had made a few trips to church via girlfriend's influence, but I do not remember using that line to rent a house. Where was Fred during this conversation? Fred was serving some time in the county jail, and I can't remember what for, but it had the word drug in the description. His wife was cute, and I rented the house and moved in quickly. I had a dog, and then I bought a horse and brought it home from the horse auction. I loved this place, and I was still using drugs and drinking, and it was the perfect hideout. I had an old Volkswagen and a job, so life was good. Picture a big guy, 6 foot tall, long hair, headbands, jewelry everywhere, and an old gold-colored, excellent-conditioned Cadillac. Did I mention he wore a white Stinson cowboy hat? My memories of Fred get cluttered because I have known him for 39 years. My earliest memories are some of the best. I'm going to jump around on this timeline, so just know that this took place between 1972 and 1979. We both drank and smoked and didn't work during the days. There were these check dams beyond the gates at the end of the canyon's paved road. During this summer, and I'm pretty sure it was 1972, we were regular attendees at the sun-drenched check dams where a lot of people gathered and partied. Fred was a big guy and carried a lot of weight at this point. He drank white wine by the gallons. He had a floating chair that required an inner tube under it to float him, and he always had a gallon jug of white wine tied to the chair on a rope. It stayed very cold at the bottom of the dam and was easily retrieved when his glass was empty. Looking back on these days, I'm amazed that no one was seriously injured. Once a kid named Billy fell backwards off the dam and landed in the rocks about 15 feet below. Everyone held their breath and waited for his response. Then he stood up and grinned and yelled, "I'm okay." There was broken glass everywhere, dogs of all sorts, cars, young tempers, and eventually a boatload of drunk drivers heading home. My Volkswagen was never serviced. What was that? It was not like someone taught me about maintenance. I guess I just thought they ran forever. It was getting harder and harder to start, and I was having to pop start it when I could find the help. One day I was late for work and it wouldn't start. I was furious. Back then I was furious all the time. Once I even ripped my own shirt off in anger. And I needed to get to work. It was stuck in a hole and I couldn't push it out and I lost it. I started picking up boulders and smashing them into the car. I walked around the entire car and was careful to destroy everything but the glass. When I was done, I was exhausted. Fred and his wife were peeking out the window in total disbelief. I was in disbelief, too, when I calmed down and looked at my car. I sat down in the driver's seat and turned the key. The fucker started right up. My brother was an auto body guy at that point, and I took it to him for help. He was in disbelief as well. So he went to work on it, and in a couple of hours, it was shaped like a Volkswagen again, one that looked like a wrinkled piece of paper. A while later, Fred and his wife got into a huge argument, and Jane ran out the front door, and Fred locked her out. She screamed and demanded that he open the door, but Fred was not having any of it, until she picked up a boulder and walked over to his prized possession, the gold Cadillac. Before she could get the boulder airborne, he was out the door and saved the car and lost the argument. "Now who's laughing, Fred?" Well, Fred blamed me for starting the whole boulder thing. Fred hit a telephone pole once while driving drunk. He left the car and later blamed it on a deer that caused him to swerve. Fred got sober 5 years before me. Smuggling backwards. My first trip surfing in Baja was fun, crazy, scary, and a moment of sadness followed by a moment of clarity. We were heading south on Highway 1. It was called 1 because it was the only one that headed south. We passed straight through Ensenada without even braking. That became the rule on every trip I ever took below the border. Keep moving until there is nothing around you but country and sweet people and waves. In fact, at some point, I realized that everything from Ensenada to San Francisco was the same. We stopped in a small town several clicks below all of the confusion, and I soon learned that the leaders of the pack, and they were brothers, and their friends needed beer for the weekend. Lots of beer. In fact, the shopkeeper had to put it on a dolly to wheel it out to their trucks. It was a warm day, and I had never been in Mexico or Baja before, and I was totally loving the vibe. We stopped for gas, and this little Mexican girl, maybe 6 or 7, came up to me with a coat hanger draped with braided bracelets. She held them up and offered me to pick one. I do not know if she spoke English, but I pointed to her, and she pulled a purple and white one off the hanger and handed it to me. It cost some small amount, and I paid her 10 times the asking and never traveled anywhere for a long, long time without that bracelet. I still have it in my Burning Man gear. Later, we got 3 of the 4 trucks stuck in a riverbed, and I mean really stuck. At one point, we had given up and started thinking about pulling the belongings out in case the high tides came. One of the brothers was sitting in a beach chair drinking beer and reading sexually explicit excerpts from Penthouse. It was a scene. A local stopped by, had a beer or two, and said he had a tractor. We were encouraged, and Bruce and I took him to get the tractor in the only unstuck vehicle we had. When he appeared following us in a stolen or borrowed tractor, which he claimed was a friend of his, everyone started cheering. We were going to give him $100 US to get us out. A couple of minutes later, the tractor was stuck with the other three trucks. Oops. So we went looking for another tractor, and we found one. These two teenagers with the tractor said they would help, but first they had to go get their father. We went back and waited. Eventually, the father and the two boys arrived with the tractor that had enormous tires, at least 6 feet tall. The father walked out into the riverbed and jumped up and down on the soil. It liquefied immediately, and he said, "No possible," and they drove away. We were giving up again when another guy spotted us, and he returned with a tractor. This was one smart dude. He calmly pulled out a very long chain, and one by one, he freed all four vehicles, and he never once got his ride near the riverbed. And here's the thing. He not only didn't ask for anything in return, he refused the money we had promised the first guy. Like I said, sweet people. We eventually ended up on a very beautiful and isolated beach. We surfed until late afternoon and then pitched our tents and relaxed. One of the guys opened a jar of peanut butter and pulled a ball of tin foil out and unwrapped a few joints. I could not believe they would smuggle pot back into Mexico. It was actually comical and everyone was laughing. The seven of them went into the dome tent and smoked the joints. I was a sober member of every 12-step program known to man, so I walked off to the cliff and watched the sun set. I was struck with a very lonely feeling. It was awkward, and I was feeling sorry for myself again. Then I had a thought, an epiphany, I guess. I realized that the only way I could feel more alone at that moment would be to walk out of that tent stoned. I was not going back to that kind of loneliness again, at least not this afternoon. Ever wonder what happened to them? Juanita and the rest of us made one step closer to Southern California, which is where she wanted to be. Never mind where the rest of us wanted to be. Yes, Pocatello, Idaho was nowhere to be, maybe, unless you were 9 years old, skiing and ice skating all winter, fishing and hunting all summer. My, how I embellished those days. All I remember is having to move again. I do not remember any talk about it or anything relevant, just that Larry was going to work at another Buick dealership, and we were moving into a new house, which would be surrounded by beautiful Fresno, California. The house was cool, and there was a big fig tree right smack in the middle of the backyard. Don't ask, I have no idea why. I attended an elementary school, fifth grade as I recall. My teacher's name was, well, never mind. If I mentioned her name, and I still remember it and how to spell it, I will give away her identity and her grandchildren will sue me for slander. She was a horrible teacher. Even I knew that. She talked all the time, never once taught a lesson or assigned homework, as she would have had to grade the homework, and that would have inconvenienced her. She did insult and embarrass anyone she could at every possible opportunity. Mary Jane got the teacher next door and evidently learned something that year. I remember a girl named Ginger. I was hopelessly in love with her, but I don't even remember if I ever even talked to her, although it feels like I did. I met a bunch of guys right away. I was never afraid of meeting people. The first thing that I remember was finishing second in a distance run. I almost beat a kid named Jeff. No one ever beat Jeff, and he had to blow it out in the end to win by a whisper. I think everyone was happy for him, but took notice of me. Soon I was a main staple in the slaughter ball game that happened twice a day at recess. I went to church a lot back then, and I had a friend whose name I cannot recall at this point, but we were tight. He was not one of the in crowd, but I didn't care. We were into model building. Maybe that was what I was doing then, and as it turned out, so was he. I cannot remember for sure. And like so many times before, just when I was getting comfortable and actually sort of happy, I heard some shocking news. Juanita was not happy in Fresno, and we were going to have to move again. Just this memory makes me shrug. So we packed our things and left for Southern California. And remember that for some reason, Juanita, from Muskogee, Oklahoma, the seventh child of seven children, and apparently spoiled, would not be happy until we got back there. We landed in Brea, California, in another new house. It was a two-story, real home, and the best part was Larry put a swimming pool in the backyard for us. I loved that guy. I took care of that pool every day before school, and Mary Jane and I once again ended up in separate classes, and this time I got the good teacher. So my friend from church in Fresno invited me up for the weekend, and I got to go. I rode a bus and his parents picked me up. I have no idea what we did. There are just no memories to recall. But I have a sense that we just did normal things that 10 and 11-year-old kids do. We had fun, and then it was time to go home. We planned his bus ride to Brea, and we rode each other all the time, and he was really excited. I don't think he had ever left Fresno before. The last letter I received from him was just before his trip to my house, and he signed it, and I remember this like it was 5 minutes ago. Come soon. On my way home from school, right about the same time I received the letter, Juanita pulled her car up to the curb and excitedly said, "Get in. We don't live there anymore." She had moved everything out that day, and we moved into a rented apartment, meaning Juanita, Danny, and me. I have no idea how we could do this. It was like a bad dream. The house was gone. Mary Jane was gone. The pool was gone. Everything was gone. Of course, there were some heavy things to deal with, even in the sixth grade. Never seeing Mary Jane and Peggy again had not yet registered, and that will be a thought for a different moment. For right now, and the reason why I wrote this, is to wonder whatever happened to that kid from Fresno. Not only did he never make the trip to Brea, he never heard from me again. I had no idea how to write about the situation, and I was too busy trying to adapt to a new environment again, so I never reached out to him. What was I to say? Something like, well, who I was, I'm not, see you later. Nope, just never writing again was much, much easier. Do you ever wonder what happened to someone? Not just once in a while, but often across the course of a lifetime? I still wonder what happened to him, and worse yet, what was he thinking about my disappearance, and what were his parents telling him to help him? Just another wake left by the Juanita Odyssey.
Please stay tuned to CoastSiderRadio.com for future broadcasts from the series, I Wore the Wrong Shirt to Work Today.